Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The scale of injustice and the level of urgency is obvious.
The great vaccine divide as wealthy nations plow ahead with booster shots. The WHO's Europe chief, Hans Kluge, joins me. Then, the people risking their lives to defend our planet. With a record number of climate activists murdered, I speak to one on the front lines and to the watchdog tracking this, Mike Davis of Global Witness. Plus,
what we're seeing is a home brew of American radicalism.
COVID and the American culture wars. Co-founder of the Lincoln Project, Steve Schmidt's take on the battle over mask mandates and vaccines. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The longer vaccine inequity persists, the more the virus will keep circulating and changing. That warning from the WHO chief, as many wealthy nations get ready to start rolling out booster shots. Here in the UK, the most vulnerable will be offered a third dose from next week. And in the United States, the Biden administration is pushing to make them widely available by Monday. Meanwhile, in poorer countries, many are still waiting for their first shot. And with vaccine uptake waning in Europe, the WHO warns that the continent could see over 200,000 additional COVID deaths by December. Here's European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in her annual State of the Union speech.
Our first and most urgent priority is to speed up global vaccination. With less than 1% of global doses administered in low-income countries, the scale of injustice and the level of urgency is obvious. This is one of the great geopolitical issues in our time.
Hans Kluge is Europe chief for the WHO, and he's joining me now from Copenhagen. Dr. Kluge, welcome to our program. So that's a pretty extraordinary number, which is, you know, as you said, nearly 250,000 potential deaths you predict in Europe by December, if certain, well, under the current circumstances. Why do you think that is happening right now?
Thank you for having me on the program. Well, what we see is that after an initial sharp increase in vaccination uptake in about 35 out of the 53 European countries, we see a plateauing. And if you look across the region, there's a huge inequity. In fact, that's the need of the hour of the day, I would say, to close the gap. In the high-income countries, 59% of the eligible population got a full series. In the upper middle income countries, 31%, and the lower middle income countries, only about 10%. So we're not getting to the desired level. We're not out of the woods yet.
The desired level is what exactly?
The European Technical Advisory Group advises 80%, but we have to take it stepwise. By the end of the year, we would like to see 40%. So in the richer countries, we're there, but not yet in the middle income and particularly the low income countries. And then if I look globally, I mean, we're speaking about 1 or 2 or 3%, like, for example, in the African region. And that's the reason why I invited, for example, the region director of the WHO of the African region to my governing board, which just closed this week, because we have to stand together. And what we need is political leadership and coordination, because there are excess doses, There are some estimates of 1.2 billion excess doses in the West between now and the end of the year, but we have to ensure that those excess doses get where they are most needed.
Okay, so I'm going to put up this graphic that we have, which shows the different income levels and the different, you know, percentages of vaccination. But I want to ask you, beyond the fact that it's plateauing, why is this happening? It's not really access, we understand. I mean, the European Commission president has said, and I think you would all agree, that after a pretty shaky start on vaccines last December, Europe has ramped them up. There are vaccines available. A lot is being put down to misinformation in certain countries. Can you expand on that and tell me what is the main reason for this lag and this inequity?
We are taking a holistic approach. So, three things. First, we have to increase the uptake. And you're hinting to that one, Christiana, indeed, that there is quite some vaccine skepticism, and this is nothing good. And the only way to tackle that one is community engagement and empowerment. I invited Dr. Anthony Fauci, the chief medical advisor to the US president, to my governing board on Monday, and we have the same issues. We need community champions. We need to involve the people and base our policies on data. This is number one, the uptake. Number two is access. Still some countries, particularly the lower income, have an issue. For example, the Central Asian countries, some countries in the East, and then globally in the African region, basic issues. Because some countries are donating 100 million, 200 million, but that's not enough. We need political leadership. We need 11 billion doses to kill off the pandemic. And the third one is to increase the production capacity, which can happen with, for example, technology transfer and at a later stage, maybe waiving of the patents and the intellectual property rights.
Okay, so can I actually then focus on that issue that you raise? You know, you say you invited the head of the African Union expert on this, and he's obviously been speaking about this, particularly about what Europe and others and the WHO, I'm sure, hoped would be a sort of partnership also with private industry. And there's still, problems. And the African Union Special Envoy has said they wanted to buy them, but they've been shut out. Let's play this.
Those manufacturers know very well that they never gave us proper access. They gave access on a very different basis when they knew that supplies were restricted at the beginning. There was no production. We all accept that there wasn't sufficient production. But they had a moral responsibility to ensure that others also had access. And we find this very sad.
So what is the WHO stance on this, Dr. Kluger? Do you agree with what he said, that they've been shut out? And if so, how does one correct that?
Well, the principle is that no one is safe until everyone is safe. I mean, the deaths and the suffering will be imprinted in our universal memory for a long time to come. But it also showed, it gave the opportunity to society to see the links between all people in the world. So we should leave really no one behind. What we need is courage, collaboration, innovation, and the political leadership. And that's, for example, why I would like to commend the President of the United States for next week organizing a virtual summit of the heads of state, because that's exactly what needs to be done. This is not a health issue. This is an issue of the heads of state, and we need global solidarity.
So, you know, you have had to accept and, I guess, suffer in the public domain a lot of complaints against the WHO, the leader of the WHO as well. And you have actually written about this. You've said that the WHO needs to look inside, needs to look at itself, and needs to learn from this pandemic. You've said learning lessons is one thing, but in order to implement those lessons, WHO itself as an organization needs to look at its own institutional fitness. The worst thing WHO can do today is be self-defensive. Can you expand on that? What then are the corrective measures the WHO should take, and especially in the area of vaccine inequity, which is something you've all talked about quite rightly for so long, and yet it still persists?
So for me, as a region director in the European region, the diagnosis is indeed quite clear. Three things. The first is that we need much more inter-region collaboration. The role of the regional offices needs to be strengthened because we are close to the countries. And that's what we're doing now. For example, I gave the example of inviting the region director, not only of the African region, but also the Eastern Mediterranean region, where we have to anticipate the health needs of the people in Afghanistan. So this is number one. Number two, we need much more political participation of the member states themselves under what we call the international health regulations, which needs to include consequences for non-observance by its signatories. And that has to include, for example, unfettered access by WHO experts to countries and access to data. If the member states themselves do not address this elephant in the room, no new treaty, no new international health regulations will make the world a safer place. And third, WHO is underpowered and underfinanced. So there needs to be much more flexible financing. We had a good session at my governing body board today. Only 16% of the funding of WHO comes from the member states, which govern our organization. 84% is very specified and earmarked. So this is another issue that the member states need to fix.
I mean, I will ask you essentially what powers do we have or do you have to hold them accountable for this? But let me first go to some practical issues that I'm sure people are going to want to know about. The boosters have been widely touted for a long time. We know that Israel, which for a long time has been sort of a test case, is working hand in hand with essentially the global community to, you know, use their data to show how what they're doing works or doesn't work. And they're doing boosters now. So the US hopes to do it. The UK is going to do it. You yourself have said we can no longer see that additional doses are so-called luxury boosters. It's an essential way to protect the most vulnerable in our society. However, the European Centre for Disease Prevention says there's no need for booster doses for the fully vaccinated. So there's still complications about should you, shouldn't you? Why do you say it's not a luxury, but it's a necessary?
Yes, I don't think there is necessarily a contradiction here. In fact, indeed, literally, as you were telling there, Christian, that for people with underlying medical conditions, it's very important because it's a way, basically, it's for people whose immunity has waned. So if you got two shots, let's say, two jabs, and your immunity has waned because of underlying medical conditions, are you more or less priority than someone who had no jab yet? When I discussed this with our experts and also with Dr. Okay. Fauci, the answer is do it all. We have doses, we need to do it all. Now for the elderly, that we never told because there the evidence is not crystal clear yet. We're following the evidence for the elderly, but we got it, let's be honest, one time wrong in the beginning, and we left many elderly people behind. And that's why I'm very appreciative to countries like Israel, who are pioneers. Because the other thing we have to consider, that if we will continue to live with SARS-CoV-2, it's not going to disappear. Let's say it becomes endemic community transmission, then we desperately need urgently good information about the impact of additional doses. So a number of frontrunner countries, as long as they share the data like Israel and the UK are doing, is very important for the rest of the world.
So let me just say what they say. I've told you what they're doing in Israel, and you've mentioned that. But here in the UK, where they hope, well, they've already sent out actually their calls for those who are compromised and who need it for the third booster. Sarah Gilbert, who's co-creator of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, has said, "We'll look at each situation. The immunocompromised and elderly will receive boosters, but I don't think we need to boost everyone. Immunity is lasting well in the majority of people." So, you know, do you agree that it is lasting well in the majority of people?
Until now, we have no evidence that the general population would need a third jab. And it's very important. Indeed, we cannot have a situation where in the world there are doctors, nurses, elderly people who haven't had their first jab yet. But at the same time, we need to follow the evidence and this evolution very, very close, because we also know what happened in Israel, that quite a proportion of the people who are infected now or end up in the hospital were the elderly people who got two jabs. So in that sense, we should be on alert.
And so let me ask you about, you know, resistance. As we talked about misinformation and some anti-vax effect, but there's also now the courtroom effect. In the United States, some of these mandates that the president has announced have been challenged, and a federal judge has temporarily blocked the state of New York just this week from forcing medical workers to be vaccinated. Just want to say for our viewers that, you know, this is an issue that's gone back, you know, 100 years, if not more, while in 1905, the U.S. Supreme Court actually upheld a law that did impose a fine for not getting the smallpox vaccine. So I guess I'm asking you whether you think, like in the U.S., mandates, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, which exist in some countries, might end up in court, and this whole thing might become a legal issue like it has in the U.S.
You're absolutely right. This is not a new issue. So the principle is that first and foremost, we have to engage the community, empower them, work with community champions, have an overload of correct information through the social media, and get people who doubt into our clinical trials and research and development, because we know that is reducing vaccine skepticism. Mandatory vaccination has also proven in certain instances to increase vaccine skepticism. At the same time, at WHO, we encourage all strategies to increase vaccination uptake as long as they respect human rights and, very important, that they will not deplete hospital workforce, which already is quite overstressed, because if mandatory measures would even lead to situations where we have less nurses or doctors working in the health field, I mean, that would have an opposite effect. So in that sense, I would say I certainly can empathize with ministers who consider this, but it should be thought through only for certain population groups and the professions exposed, and with a number of caveats. And we're very happy to think through case by case if the country wants us to help them.
Well, you're probably addressing the fact that there's a crisis in certain hospitals, like in France. There's a shortage of anaesthetists. Some operations have had to be, you know, cancelled or postponed because the anaesthetists or the health workers won't take the vaccine that's been mandated. In the United States as well, we've heard anecdotal evidence that some operations, some procedures have had to be cancelled because health workers won't. I mean, you're saying there should be caveats for health workers, but that, I mean, doesn't that sound so counterintuitive? If a health worker, one of those modeling professionals, one of those, you know, people who you know, stand at the top of this particular crisis, if they won't take the vaccine, why should anybody else take it?
Well, I think that we're not going to combat the pandemic if the healthcare workers are not vaccinated. That's true. So it's a balance that we have to strike here. And we have to work with those people who can convince the skepticist. Often, there's a lot of misinformation. I see that in many countries, policies are being developed based on assumptions, perceptions. So it's very important that we do what we call formative research. I created a unit here on behavior and culture insights. We have done in 34 countries surveys to really have a good, accurate, evidence-informed ID, what's in the mind of the people, and then tailor solutions community by community. And in a majority of the cases, it works. But There is no doubt vaccines work, vaccines save lives and many lives, and it even has the potential to decrease transmission if everyone participates.
It's a long, hard slog ahead. Dr. Hans Kluge, thank you so very much for joining us. Another crisis is also taking lives. Recent extreme weather events, as we've seen, have laid bare the threats posed by the climate catastrophe. In Germany and Belgium, 220 people lost their lives in severe floodings this summer. In China, some 20 inches of rain fell in just 2 days, killing more than 300 people. And in the northeastern United States, dozens died after flash floods from the remnants of Hurricane Ida all the way down south. And while climate activists rally to save the planet, many of them are facing increasing violence. A whopping 227 environmentalists were murdered last year. That is according to Global Witness, which says most of the killings happened in Latin America. I'm joined now by its CEO, Mike Davis, and by Mexican climate activist, Margarita Campuzano. Thank you both very much for joining me. So you've written about this, Mike Davis. Can I ask you why this is happening now? And why particularly, as we've mentioned, in places like Latin America, including Mexico, we've got the Philippines, those seem to make the bulk of these cases where it's violent for the activists.
Yes, thanks, Christiane. So in 2020, these 227 land and environmental defenders were killed essentially because of the relentless expansion of a predatory and climate-wrecking resource exploitation model, which takes no account of national laws, does not subscribe to international norms. And when people get in the way, people on the front lines standing up for their rights, they face intimidation, incarceration, attacks, and sometimes even murder. So this is both a symptom and a cause of the climate crisis, which is affecting us all.
So let me just write, you know, again, 2020 in this regard was the worst year on record. And you've mentioned, you know, vital interests. And of course, the journalist, the climate journalist, Bill McKibben, wrote the foreword to your report. And this is what he said. They're at risk because they find themselves living on or near something that some corporation is demanding. That demand, the demand for the highest possible profit, the quickest possible timeline, the cheapest possible operation, seems to translate eventually into the understanding somewhere that the troublemaker must go. Mike, do you know and have your investigations shown who is responsible? You've mentioned certain vested interests, but who's responsible for carrying out the violence? Is it government, non-government? Is it military, paramilitary? Is it individuals taking what they think is the law into their own hands?
Yes, thanks, Christiane. What we find in many of these cases where we can clearly identify an association between a killing in a particular industry, and the most deadly ones tend to be those to do with logging, agribusiness, and mining, is that you have a nexus of companies or a company and also people who are part of or associated with state security forces. But it's worth bearing in mind that when we talk about companies, although the ones who are most directly implicated may be local firms that you and I and most of CNN's audience hasn't heard of, they are invariably plugged into global commodity supply chains. They're very often dependent on global flows of international finance. And that's where larger companies come in and really need to face up to their complicity in these killings. And that's why we're calling for governments, not just in countries which are dangerous for defenders, but also countries, large economic jurisdictions, including the EU, where many large multinational companies are domiciled, to introduce legislation which would require companies to do checks, the jargon is due diligence, along their supply chains to make sure that the commodities which they are sourcing are not being produced in a way which gives rise to or has benefited from these types of attacks and killings. And such legislation needs to be backed with clear criminal liability and strong penalties if it's to be effective. Happily, we do have an opportunity for such legislation in the EU coming out later this year.
Well, we'll wait to see whether that actually produces the results you're talking about. Let me turn to you, Margarita Campuzano, because there you are in Mexico. You're right on the front lines. There was just this week or last, yet another activist was killed in the state of Morelos, I think it is. Let's just put up the graphic that we have that shows Colombia, Mexico, the Philippines, other Latin American and Central American countries, which are the most offending countries. And while we do that, let me ask you, Margarita, what you have had to experience, how you've seen this unfold in Mexico, and why Mexico is number two on that list of essentially killing activists like yourself and those on the ground.
Yeah, thank you very much, Christian. Yes, well, in Mexico, violence against environmental defenders in Mexico is a structural and systematic problem that has been going on for decades. Neither past governments nor this government have been able to stop it. And we accompany a lot of communities, indigenous and rural communities along the country, in the defense of their land, their natural resources. And sometimes we have been also been victims of some threats or some delegitimization, even from the president, unfortunately, but mostly are these people in the communities that you are mentioning, these indigenous people that live in the communities where the mega projects are being done, the main victims of these kind of aggressions, and a different kind of aggressions that go from threats to criminalization, kidnapping, and even murder. Last year, we registered 18 homicides from environmental defenders, and this year we have counted or registered 13 so far.
So, Margarita, your organization works to legally represent individuals or organizations who are being threatened like this. According to Mike's report and Global Witness, I think it's like 95% of those, the offenders don't result in prosecution. How is this going to change? Why do you think in your country and others, because I guess you've looked into it, they're not held accountable? Impunity is the word of the moment.
Yes, that's the main problem in Mexico. We have a lot of impunity in that. The cases are not followed. Nobody is being sentenced because of these crimes. And I think it's because of this big dispute among the economic interests and political interests that are involved. In one hand, you have we are the fifth country with most mega diverse in the planet, but a lot of indigenous and rural people live in these communities. On the other hand, we have this development model that seeks for extractivism and mega projects, and these two interests collapse. And that's why even in a federal state, federal level or state level, they are not interested in prosecuting these cases because they think it's going to represent a loss of employment, a loss of investment. And that is the problem we are facing. And sometimes it's also because in many cases there are officials involved in these kind of situations also.
So, Mike, I mean, you hear that. Obviously, you know, you know about these things and you've talked about it in the report. It looks like from the report that the level of killings in Mexico and the violence, 67% increase in number of attacks from 2019 to 2020. In Africa, almost double the number of killings compared to, you know, in 2020 compared to the year before. Specifically, I mean, you've talked about a European law that you hope is going to do something. But wider around the world, is there anything that you would say right now, if you could wave a magic wand, that could actually be done institutionally and make a difference?
Yes, thank you, Christiane. I very much wish I had that magic wand. I think it is a case of governments in the countries where these land and environmental defenders are at most risk, ensuring that there are legal protections in place for freedom of assembly, freedom to demonstrate, clear environmental and social impact assessment requirements for projects of the kind which we see implicated in these killings, and also recognition and enforcement of the right for indigenous people and communities to what's called free, prior and informed consent before projects happen. And at the more global level, we do need to see, as I mentioned, the main economies, whether that's individual countries or blocs like the EU, passing legislation which makes companies accountable. Now, one thing which could happen in the next few months would be if those countries which are coming together at COP in November undertook to introduce such legislation across the board and do so within the next year or two, that would make a very big difference, and it would have an immediate introduce an immediate shift to the tone of the debate. Companies would have to start taking notice, and then in due course there would be real accountability, which is what we need.
Margarita, let me ask you, because again, you're right, you know, on the front lines of this. And of course, everybody knows, and Bill McKibben has written in the report that, you know, essentially what you and activists and everybody's trying to do is defend our shared habitat, our shared planet, and try to mitigate this catastrophe that's been built up, that we created it and we have the solution in terms of humans. Tell me, just as a personal feeling, having done this for so long, what, you know, what kind of toll it takes on you, and what hope do you have? I mean, COP26 is coming up, the next big international conference on this. How much hope do you have that where we are can be reversed or mitigated?
Well, I don't think that a lot is going to be achieved in this upcoming COP, because the COVID has presented a lot of challenges, and a lot of countries will not be able to go because they are in the red list. That's to begin with. But secondly, I am happy because I can see we have been following the COP for the past 10 years, and I see that the theme of justice and environmental defenders and climate justice is now a main issue. That it was not like that. I mean, 10 years ago, it was all about mitigation and adaptation only, and everything in terms of, you know, the greenhouse emissions. But now they are more and more talking about justice, climate justice, and migrations and indigenous communities that are also present in the COPs. So I am happy about that. Also, they are including more and more a gender perspective in these COPs. And well, that's my hope, that this thing is going to be moving forward.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It has become a main issue, certainly for a very large demographic, mostly young people. And even, Mike, it is a main issue in Germany, which is going to go to elections. And people are very energized about this. It's their future. But you also profile a specific case in South Africa where a local activist, she was protesting, I think it was a coal mining concession bordering their community. What happened to her? And she was killed in 2020.
Yes, that's right, Christiane. So this is the case of Fikile Nshangazi, who was a 65-year-old grandmother who became an activist when she saw the impacts that a nearby open-cast coal mine were having on her community in terms of the health, the very infrastructure of the place. And she began organizing with fellow community members to oppose a proposed expansion of this coal mine, which is being pushed by a company called Tendele Coal. And it was in the context of her work that people in the community who were resisting the expansion efforts were being made to buy them off. Evidence came to light after Fikile's killing of threats made against others. And in this situation, one day in October last year, four men came to her house. They spoke to her 11-year-old grandson who was there in the yard. They went inside and they shot her dead in her living room. And to date, nobody's been held accountable for this killing. The company, Tendele Coal, denies that it's anything to do with them, but there is very little doubt that they're heavily implicated in creating the conditions of conflict and division in which she was murdered.
Okay, well, I guess, you know, just finally to both of you, when you look down the road, and let me ask you, Margarita, you've talked about your hope, you've talked about, you know, how it's become so front and center for so many people around the world. Do you see a point? You know, we're all worried because there's so many you know, experts who say in the blink of an eye, it's going to be too late, and these big countries are not meeting their targets, like China, the US, and the others. Just give me your sense of how much the activist community is, I guess, responsible for pushing this issue front and center now.
I think it's essential, the fact that the world is now more and more interested in what is happening with the environmental defenders, because they are the ones who are actually fighting, you know, and helping us to fight climate change. And the fact that now the world is watching and putting pressure on the governments, we need the world to see what is happening in Mexico, so the government feels pressure and feels obligated to fulfill the commitments that we made, you know, before the UN and the climate, to the climate fight. So that's my hope, and that's what I think it will happen. But if we do not protect the environmental defenders, if the government does not provide more economic, human resources and guarantees their right to information, participation, and to be involved in the projects that are affecting their land and natural resources, we cannot do anything from, you know, the urban spaces. We can talk a lot, but the things are happening there in the communities where the ecosystems are being damaged.
Margarita Campuzano, Mike Davis, thank you both very much for joining us on this really important topic, of course, existential one. And protecting the planet has been a key issue also, of course, for the California governor, Gavin Newsom. And he has just handily beat back a recall challenge from Republicans who were pointing to his climate agenda, amongst other things. Newsom has also staked his reputation on mask and vaccine mandates. And that's in stark contrast to Republican governors from states like Texas and Florida who have not. GOP strategist Steve Schmidt says their anti-science stand is a selfish ploy to woo the far right. Schmidt, who resigned from the board of the Lincoln Project in February, tells Michel Martin how Democrats should seize the day.
Thanks, Christian. Steve Schmidt, thank you so much for joining us once again.
It's good to be back with you.
So I'm going to just start by asking you, how do you understand what's going on right now? I mean, as we are speaking, a number of Republican governors are just furious about both mask mandates and vaccine mandates, even though their states are among the most heavily affected. I mean, at one point, one out of seven new infections were coming out of COVID-19 infections are coming out of Florida at the same time that the governor there is suing jurisdictions for imposing mask mandates. So how do you understand what's going on in our politics right now?
I think the proper way to look at this is part of a ongoing series of events at a very momentous time, in a momentous season. And what we're seeing is a home brew of American radicalism, extremism, a type of nihilism. For sure, Ron DeSantis of Harvard University understands completely the efficacy of these life-saving vaccines, but he has gambled. And his gamble is that it is expeditious for him to climb the ladder of power in the Republican Party, to position himself as an heir to Trump, to be, with regard to COVID, with regard to the mass mandates, to cater to an extreme and intense base that he views will be determinative in the next Republican primary process. Now, Saudi Arabia is a good example of how to think about this. You have the king. The king is Trump. My view is that Trump will certainly be the Republican nominee in 2024, but he won't be around forever. So when you look at Abbott in Texas, when you look at DeSantis in Florida, when you look at Noem in South Dakota, when you look at others, what you see now is a battle amongst the crown princes and princesses for control of the MAGA empire. And the things that they're doing to get to the top very sadly demonstrate a profound callousness towards life, towards any sense of public responsibility, and it all accumulates into what we're seeing right now, literally in the history of the country. You've never seen people, no matter how corrupt they are, charged with actual life and death responsibility, abdicate that responsibility for their selfish political interest. And so we're in this bidding war right now to see how extreme it can get to gain favor in this era of negative partisanship, where the louder the outrage is from the majority, from the majority of normal people, such as it is in this country, the more fuel they will have to advance their political rise inside of MAGA.
I wanted to hear a little bit more about the Saudi Arabia analogy. Like, why do you say that? Is it because you're saying sort of educated elite? Just because people are educated elites doesn't mean that they have the same worldview and the same sense of what the purpose of the nation is. Like, tell a little bit more about why that's the analogy you draw on.
Well, I think it's important that we stop pretending. That we stop pretending that men like Kevin McCarthy, Ron DeSantis, Greg Abbott don't understand the efficacy of vaccines, don't understand basic American history, that they don't understand the lawful authority of government at a federal level, at a state level, at a county level to enforce quarantines if necessary for the purposes of the public health, for the public good. This is as old as the country itself, the exercise of this type of lawful authority. So let's stop pretending that any of these people think it's a good idea to take horse dewormer, or that it's okay to inject some type of household disinfectant. They all know this is insanity. Every one of them knows for sure there wasn't election fraud. They know that Joe Biden won the election. Yet every time they speak and they lie about these things, we're all supposed to pretend that they're making these statements as part of a conviction or some level of good faith. And the evidence contrary to that is their own spoken words over the course of many years. So let's stop pretending. What we have in this country is an extremist movement that's autocratic, that has rejected central pillars of American democracy. It's ascendant. It's on the march. It's both more extreme, more powerful, and more prepared for victory in September of 21 than it was in January of 21 when the insurrection took place in the first place.
Tom Ridge, another former governor of Pennsylvania, former head of the Department of Homeland Security, called this the Taliban wing of the Republican Party. And so the question is, why? Why did that take over so quickly? I think you dispute this, but I'm sort of arguing, is it that identity politics was always more important to the party than perhaps people were willing to admit? And by that, I mean white identity politics. Or is it something else? Is it some sort of continuum of things? What do you say? What do you think it is?
At each instance of Black progress, or even maybe more devastatingly, when there was hope for Black progress in the 1870s until Reconstruction ended and it was snuffed out, there's a profound white lash, a backlash to that Black progress. I believed largely for a lot of my adult life that the civil rights movement was largely over. And it had been achieved with the election of a Black president. I had a profound naivete, and I'm not alone in this, about the backlash that came for our having a Black president in this country. And we've seen that manifested over these years from a whisper, and maybe people less naive for me were able to hear it better, and it wasn't such a whisper to them, or even a signal at all. But now what we see is loud, overt, clear as day, hundreds of pieces of legislation that are set to break what I thought was an understanding that we all had in this country, whether you were Republican or Democrat, which is that we all get a say, regardless of our creed, our race, our gender, our sexual orientation. This is what's been shattered here. This is what Trump has broken. And so now for the purposes of power, you see people claiming that freedom requires that some of us don't get to participate. Mm-hmm. This is always the argument that right-wing authoritarians make.
So we talked about the DNA of the Republican Party and how it has evolved in recent years. What about the Democrats? What would you say is the DNA of the Democratic Party right now?
Well, the Democratic Party is the majority, but it is a fragile coalition. And I think it's really important to understand that coalition, which extends from Republicans who've only cast a couple of votes, who are a small part of it, but determinative in victory, all the way to AOC. And what that coalition has in common is a belief in democracy, in the dignity of the human being above the power of the state. That coalition put Nancy Pelosi in the speaker's chair in 2018. It fell apart by 2020. It did not hold together below Joe Biden, though it came back briefly together for the two Senate races in Georgia. And now this coalition is being tested, and it will be tested by the type of attacks that Donald Trump is making that are race-based, full of animus, that are essentially this: to those white Republicans, those independent voters, Republican men, Republican women, what they're saying is, you may not like Trump, but these people over here, the ones that are trying to indoctrinate your kids with critical race theory, they hate you. They want to teach your kids to hate you. They want to take your possessions. They are waging a culture war, right? And they are inciting a passionate minority. The Democratic Party, and we'll get a good look at this in California, I think is not as intense, not as focused as the Republicans are at taking power right now. It's the more docile of the parties. It's not fierce enough. It has not done a good job of holding the extremism back over the last 9 months. So this coalition, while larger, is more vulnerable, more diverse, more diffuse, more disagreeable than the cult of personality that it's facing.
A number of columnists have sort of said in recent days that, you know, Democrats seem worried about offending Republicans and Republicans want to win. And so how do you understand their sort of reluctance to for example, to take steps that would forestall these restrictions on voter access, for example? They're really, at this point, there's really only one way to do it, and that is through federal legislation. So how do you understand the Democrats' reluctance to address these issues?
I don't understand it. This was inevitable. It was predictable. And there's no issue that should make Democrats or any person who loves democracy more furious than this. In response to the lie about the stolen election, there was an actual vote that took place where 147 Republicans voted to nullify and disenfranchise the votes of millions of Black Americans on the basis of BS. What followed next was the first filings of legislation. The intent of every piece of legislation is malice. That's because none of it would have ever been filed if Donald Trump had won the election. And every piece is designed to make it more difficult for minorities to vote, but most importantly, to make it more difficult to certify elections when one side factlessly claims fraud. And so this was coming. And the only way to stop it was the repeal of the filibuster. And from the very beginning, the repeal of the filibuster should have been framed by Democratic leaders as a moral necessity and an act of last resort, should Republicans dare try to unravel the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965 and pull this country back. And so across the broad front of an unrelenting series of events, the Democratic Party as a whole has done a horrendous job confronting the growing extremism in this country and framing for the American people the terrible place where it all leads. The filibuster is part of that.
But I'm asking you why. I mean, you know these people. Why do you think that is?
I'm not a psychologist. What I can tell you about politics is this, is restraint in the exercise of power is an underappreciated virtue. But the exercise of power at necessary times and times bluntly is a prerequisite for effective leadership. Democrats have the majority. They should pass Roe versus Wade statutorily. They should act with all the power they have to bring this pandemic to an end by increasing liability for companies that won't act responsibly. Democrats will soon be asking their donors for hundreds of millions of dollars. They will be asking to elect candidates. They must be able to explain to what end. And if the Democratic Party and its most important loyal constituency, Black Americans, cannot count on the leadership of the party to be all in as a moral proposition to defend voting and civil rights, 150 years on, 5 years before the 250th anniversary of this country, the voters will be disappointed at a level that is beyond my ability to articulate, and it will have the effect in the end of propelling a fascist movement back into congressional power, in my view, in this country.
I know you've been asked this before, but you know, the Lincoln Project tweeted earlier this year that said, our mission is clear, destroy the Republican Party. But you know, I know you've been asked a lot about sort of the tactics, and I have to ask sort of this again, is just this kind of this fight fire with fire approach. Part of your message to folks is that you're getting screwed and these are the people doing the screwing. But the former president's messages to the people that he cared about was, you're getting screwed and I'm going to fix it. If everybody's message is, you're getting screwed and I'm going to fix it, where do we go from here as a country?
I think the country's in a lot of trouble. And I want to speak to what I'll call the both-siderisms that I think is inherent in the frame of the question. In fact, critical race theory isn't being taught to kids in high schools in America. One political party is not lying about a life-saving vaccine. One political party is not partly responsible for hundreds of thousands of dead Americans because of those lies. One political party hasn't whitewashed the insurrection on 1/6, and one political party is not a danger to American democracy. And there's not a symmetry between the two sides, the rottenness, and frankly, the evil. And we don't use that word enough, but I need to linger here for a second. There was a meeting that took place in the White House that Jared Kushner chaired, I'm sure, with coffee and donuts and all the good stuff. And they decided in that meeting that there wouldn't be a COVID strategy for the blue states because they could pin it on the blue state governors. It's evil. It killed hundreds of thousands of people in this country. We're about to enter into the children's pandemic. So anything that we can do, grab people by the proverbial collar, by the neck, hit them in the head, get their attention, make them laugh, make them cry, make them think, anything to get them to wake up and understand the danger that we face in this country from extremists. And in the fight for American democracy, exhaustion is our enemy. The idea that there's not a difference between the two sides. Everybody is equally corrupt. Everyone is equally maliced. And it's just not true.
Steve Schmidt, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Throwing down the gauntlet, defending democracy. And finally tonight, some of Broadway's biggest shows have finally reopened after the pandemic lockdown. Hamilton, The Lion King, Wicked, and Chicago are all welcoming audiences back, provided they have been vaccinated and they do wear masks. And audiences can hardly contain their excitement. No one mourns the wicked, as the song goes, but for theater lovers, the long hiatus on Broadway won't be as easily dismissed. Wicked's original Glinda, Kristen Chenoweth, gave a surprise speech before last night's show, and one fan got so emotional, he said he felt his soul leave his body. And there was also an appearance by the current king of Broadway himself.
Sky spreading.
Lin-Manuel Miranda there outside the theater showing Hamilton and taking a leaf from a Hollywood songbook and paying tribute to New York, proving that even when the lights go dark, the show will always find a way to go on. That is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.